How you doing? My name is Jim C., and this is an oral history of Marie S., a member of the Cedarhurst Ulick Group, with a sober date of 7/11/83. Hi, Marie, and welcome to an oral history of your time in sobriety. Marie, please tell me a little bit about your life before you found AA, when and where you were born. What kind of childhood did you have?
Well, thank you, first of all, Jimmy, for inviting me. Very, very privileged to share with you today. So I was born in New York City, born and raised there, actually on the Lower East Side, 7th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue was happening there, everything. I mean, really. And I had a peer group that probably I gravitated towards people like myself. I'm an only child. My mom was already gone. So I looked for people like that. And I still have friends to this day that fit into that category. But I think early on, the first time I think I can recall really drinking, I did get drunk on that first outing. So could have been an indication, but most of us don't look at those signposts. But that was probably about 14 or 15. And I'm sure I had a blackout, and I do recall getting into trouble. My dad was the hell, kind of, and kind of went on from there.
Okay. As a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, let's see. I think I probably would have liked to have been maybe a veterinarian. I did love animals, still do. That was kind of a thought I had early on. Yeah, I remember that.
Okay. How did you start drinking?
Well, as I said, I wouldn't say it was peer pressure. It was just kind of everybody doing that. So I kind of fell in with that, and never realizing that it would become a problem for me. It was just something to do. I hear most stories begin like that. I certainly didn't wake up one day and say, oh, I better not drink because I'm going to become an alcoholic. I just went along with the flow.
Okay. When and how did your drinking get out of control?
Yeah, well, as I said, even the first time that I remember drinking and getting really drunk and in a blackout, I don't know if it went right to 100 from there, but it progressed pretty quickly. Of course, back in those days in the 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of other stuff going on. I'm not going to mention that, but we would just hang out drinking Tompkins Square Park, a couple of bottles of wine, and it just kind of went from there.
Okay. When did you know you had hit bottom?
Well, I think I was living on top of a bar called La Bamba, and they barred me from that particular bar, and I was insulted. But I kind of knew that my drinking was pretty much out of control at that point. I don't know that that was my bottom, because I didn't get sober right away until I moved out of that neighborhood. But I knew that, you know, I'd have to do something. And I do remember one time I called New York Intergroup, and I don't know where that thought came from. I just picked up the phone book and looked up Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called, and I didn't do much with it from there. But I kind of knew my drinking was not normal at that point. That was going to be a start, but I didn't get sober right away.
Okay. Now we're going to move into the recovery portion of the interview. When did you first hear of AA, and from what source? As you mentioned, it was the phone book.
Yeah, I came out of a blackout one morning, afternoon, whatever, and somehow I said, I'm going to call AA. I don't know where that thought came from, honest to God. I believe today that it was divine intervention. I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know of anybody who was going. And I called New York Intergroup, and I do remember they were very nice. How can I help you? And they sent me to my first meeting, which was at, it was Cabrini Hospital on 20th Street and First Avenue. And that was the first time I was ever exposed to AA.
Okay, so you started to get sober in Manhattan, and what did you think of your first meeting?
That meeting, I remember very distinctly. Some guy came over to me and handed me a paper that said KISS, KISS, which is an acronym in AA called Keep It Simple, Stupid. And I thought, the heck is this guy checking me out? I mean, that's how arrogant I was. I didn't get it. But I do remember the woman, and it was a woman, sharing from the podium about how she didn't have to drink with she mentioned all these horrific things that I thought, how is that possible? Lost her apartment, got divorced, got mugged, didn't have to drink. Those words were like so resonant in my head, but of course I left and probably didn't go back for another couple of years.
Can you tell me about your early sobriety, your work through the steps, and problems you had in those first days of learning the AA way?
So I continued to go to a few meetings in Manhattan. I was still living on 12th Street and 2nd Avenue. And I went to one of the really old groups, the Greenwich Village Group, and they had a beginners meeting there. I'll never forget. It was a panel of three speakers for 6 months. And it was very informative, and I continued to go there. And I didn't stay sober. And eventually I moved out to Brooklyn, and my sobriety really started there at the Prospect Group. Also, another old. I've been very fortunate. I've been to meetings, groups rather, that were solid. That Prospect Group is going to be 75 years old. The Greenwich Village Group is still in, in operation. So I felt something's going on here that's permanent, and that was impressive to me. So in Brooklyn, early on, they were very hard, like, we don't want to know what you know, you don't know anything. And they let you spin around a little bit, but they were very, very old school. Sit down, be quiet, we don't really want to hear from you. And somehow I like that because I'm hard myself, and I said, wow, these people don't play. So I just got a feel that there was a routine, a discipline, and I better get with that. So that was impressive to me. I didn't really love it, but I paid attention.
Okay. Can you tell me a little about your work through the steps, problems you had in those first days of
Yeah.
learning the AA way?
Well, I mean, in Brooklyn, we had a step meeting. And you were expected to go to that. That was a Thursday night. We read from the 12 and 12, and you worked with a sponsor. And I don't know, I mean, it wasn't like they were hard, but they weren't like beating you up with this way of life. This is, here it is. Here are the steps. And what impressed me was, here are the steps we took, which is suggested. So, in other words, it wasn't just theory. So this is the way it's going to work, and again, get on board with this. So I didn't really fight it, but it wasn't something that I really like took to right away.
Okay, what was AA's reputation in the community?
Actually, it was, Brooklyn after Akron really was a hub of AA. So there was a lot of churches that wanted AA, had them at the, encouraged them to come in. And so I think it had a very good reputation actually back, this was in the early 80s. So there were tons of meetings in Brooklyn. all over. And I think the churches or community centers, whoever was housing that particular group, I wouldn't say respected, but they were enthusiastic to have a meeting there.
Okay. How was it different or similar from what you encountered through your initial introduction?
Well, in 91, I was already 8-9 years sober. I moved out here to Nassau County, and God working in my life put me right in walking distance of my home group now, Cedarhurst Hewlett. So I felt I was able to walk to that meeting, which I did in Brooklyn. It was an urban setting. This disease is so cunning, baffling, and powerful. I thought, well, I came from Brooklyn, or you don't know what I know, and this, that, and the other. And it took me close to a slip to understand I have to fit in, not fit into my, you know. So it took a little while, 91, but I'm grateful for that lesson. That was the closest in all the years I've been sober that I ever came to drinking. I was sick at that time. I had herniated discs. I had moved again. Like I said, had no home group out here. So the disease had a way of like wheedling in, and I paid attention to that. That was the first time I called out to God and said, "You're going to have to help me," because I was very close at that point.
How has your perception of AA changed over time?
Well, I don't know that my perception has changed. I mean, I need AA, so whatever's happening on any given day, I have to fit into that routine. I can't upset a group or a service commitment with my opinion, and that is not Marie, because here's my opinion, I'm not using it, you know, kind of thing. Whereas now I try and offer my experience, and it came hard. So I have to pick the hill I want to die on today. But there are a lot of things that I see that I may not like, but I just have to say, all right, maybe that's my perception, as your question was. And I have to just contend prior to investigation is not good for alcohol.
Did you have a sponsor when you first came in?
I did. I've had three sponsors in my close to 39 years. The first sponsor I had, I still see her occasionally. Her name is Marie. We used to have the standing joke, "I'm Marie, I'm an alcoholic." "No, I'm Marie, I'm an alcoholic." And she was instrumental in helping me get to meetings early on. My second sponsor, Mary from the Prospect Group, kind of had a breakdown in the middle of her sponsoring me, and now I have my sponsor, Anne-Marie, who is just amazing. Her sponsor, Teddy, who I always talk about, got sober while Bill Wilson was still alive, so I feel a direct connection to the co-founders.
So you would say you had a really good sponsorship?
I would, okay. Yeah.
When you first came in, were there a lot of meetings and groups in existence?
Well, again, in Brooklyn, there were. I mean, you couldn't. Bay Ridge, Bensonhurst, downtown Brooklyn, where Bill, the Hotel George. I mean, there were quite a few meetings. I mean, lots of meetings, actually.
Can you recall the formats used at some of those early meetings?
Yeah, most of them were either closed or open. I don't recall any specialty meetings. There might have been a woman's meeting here or there. I didn't really go to those. So open meeting, I used to attend on a Sunday, closed meeting on a Thursday. And my observation over the years is most of the groups that were still in existence now had an open meeting and a step meeting, which was the closed meeting. That was pretty much it early on.
Which individual, you mentioned the three sponsors you've had. Would you like to mention any other individuals who were especially prominent in your sobriety?
Well, yeah. There were quite a few women early on that, when I went to one of my first meetings at the Greenwood Group, which was a very odd crew. It was in a clubhouse, had whales on the wall, longshoremen come to the door. I already knew, no. And these two women, Helen and Johanna, I'll never forget, when I was still shaken, they said, here, you could sit here. I try to get through this without becoming emotional, and I can't do it. Those women are both gone now, and Johanna was tough. Helen was a little wishy-washy. She would get up and start crying just like I did, but Helen would go around the room and collect all the cups. So obviously, I guess these people had help or maids or whatever, but Helen picked up all those cups, and that was her 12-step work. And Johanna was a little more vocal. She went on to do some service and whatever. But those two women, if they didn't reach out to me at that particular day in Greenwood, I don't think I would have continued on.
Well, gratitude is what generates a lot of emotion in recovered alcoholics. And so it's not surprising to me that when you talk about those special individuals who were prominent in your sobriety, that you would get emotional. Would you like to describe any step work that you did early in your sobriety that sticks out in your mind?
We used to go to one particular group in Bay Ridge. It was called the Third Step Workshop. And we would go there every week. I think it was a Friday night. And I'm of the opinion, if you do not have a solid third step, I don't see how you're going to do a fourth step or a fifth step. So that particular meeting group, rather, was instrumental. And I'll never forget, it was, then there was another group, probably also in Bay Ridge, was an 11-step workshop. So those steps somehow were in my psyche, and I thought, wow, okay, well, this is spiritual, you know. It's, to me, again, if you're getting beat up, you better do this fourth step, and you don't have a third step, I think you're just wasting your time. That's my only personal observation.
Would you like to tell me about some of your experience with sponsoring others?
Early on, there was a woman in the Prospect group who asked me to sponsor her. Her name was Elaine, and I knew she was a gay woman, and I thought, can I sponsor this woman? And we had a fairly good relationship as sponsor and someone sponsoring. I had a couple of other over the years. I mean, it's helped me because I say, well, I'm going to have to walk the walk. I can't just say, no, you go to a meeting, call me at 7 in the morning. That I don't do that. But if you're not making meetings, then don't call me and use me like a therapist or a doctor or whatever. Because everything you're going to find at the home group. So, you know, the women I've sponsored over the years, a lot of them have stayed sober. A lot of them kind of drifted off, and I'm okay with that. I took a cue from Teddy, who had, when we would go to a meeting, there would be 6 or 7 girls sitting around her. And I'd say, wow. And everybody knew this woman. But she wasn't like Liz, you know, our Liz, who we just lost. You know how many people call her sponsor? But I don't think it's something that, I don't know. It's a special relationship. I think people now, they go through the steps in a minute. I don't see that happening. For me to sponsor you, we have to build a relationship. We have to get to know one another, no judgment, and that's how I approach it.
Okay, thank you. And that concludes the recovery portion of the interview, and now we will move on to the unity portion of the interview, which focuses on group issues and community perception of AA. Today, conference-approved literature is available to help AA members deal with a wide variety of challenging questions. Early on, all you had was the book Alcoholics Anonymous and your experience. What did you think of the big book, and how often did you use it?
So in Brooklyn, the big book was something that seemed to be more of a cult kind of a thing. There was one guy that I never forget. He said, you're going to have to come with me to Greenwich, Connecticut every week, and we're going to, it was where Marty Mann got sober, I don't know. And I said, what? Why do we have to do that? I didn't have a good feeling about that because I knew about cults being... But anyway, it either went militant or nobody cared about it. That was what I observed. And today I look at it a little differently because it's a spiritual way of life. And I don't think anybody can beat that into you or teach it to you or make you do it. Like you said, gratitude, you have to pay it forward. So anything that I've learned out of that book, I don't say, well, page 83 is the promises and look it up. I like to try and present it as I feel it, as I experience it.
Okay, you've mentioned already how early AAs treated newcomers. How did your group treat constant slippers?
Well, early on in Brooklyn, there were quite a few. There were a couple of guys who were like really characters. But they would just, you know, if they were disruptive or making the meeting one guy would come in with a shopping cart and take all the cookies home. And I mean, it was kind of comical, but you could tell he wasn't sober. But I don't recall people ever judging or saying you don't belong here. But in Brooklyn, they didn't tolerate a lot of nonsense. Either you want this and you better pay attention or, you know.
How were 13th steppers treated?
Yeah. Well, like I say, a couple of these women, I remember one time some guy was approaching one of the girls and Teddy would get in right between and say, how's your wife doing? And I went, wow. They were very protective of the women. And some of the women were maybe the predatory type and they straightened them out too. So, you know.
How were people wishing to talk about multiple addictions during your meetings addressed?
Yeah, well, some of the early meetings I went to in Brooklyn, if you said drugs, we don't want to hear about drugs. And, you know, they tolerated a little bit, but not too much. And I would say at the early part of my getting sober, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict. Then I started to drop that because I said, I know I'm a drug addict, but I don't have to let everybody... I'm in AA, and, you know, but there were some groups that you just knew, don't talk about drugs here, and and that was it. So sometimes you didn't go to that group. That was their group conscience. They didn't want to hear about it. So
there are a few of those left, but yeah. They are becoming more few and far between. We say sometimes that all that's needed to form an AA meeting is two drunks, a resentment, and a coffee pot. Can you talk at all about the differences that led to new groups being formed in your area?
Yeah, again, early, there were very solid groups that I was fortunate enough to go to. So back in those days, we used to fight to make the coffee. I mean, the service was instilled in you right away. You were able to be of service and you could make the coffee. That's about all you could do. But I don't recall really people getting too upset and saying, I'm not going to that group. I'm going to go down the road. And there were plenty of groups. That's the point, you know. So I didn't really see that, to tell you the truth. I don't recall it.
Okay. In AA Comes of Age, Bill W. writes about numerous issues over which anger and contention arose and threatened the undoing of our fellowship. The groups nationwide, for example, did not immediately accept the spiritual principles which we know today as the 12 traditions. What controversies over issues addressed in the traditions can you recall people wrestling with?
We'd have a tradition meeting every month at the end of the month, and that would always make for lively discussion because there were a couple of people who just wanted to be argumentative. And the traditions are there to be discussed, they're traditions, meaning they're traditional. Let's not try and, you know, upset what works. But I know even Bill early on just, you know, people didn't want to hear about that. But guess what? Those things really saved us. I mean, when they broke away from the Oxford group, that was a good thing. But down the road, you know, I mean, we had to have some guideposts as to what we should be doing and what we ideally would like to do. So I don't have a problem with the traditions. I love them.
Was rent for the meetings or other funding obtained by things like gambling sessions or bingo games?
We had one clubhouse that I remember that was kind of, they had their own rent and stuff like that. But if you belong to the clubhouse, that was one thing. But I don't remember, in fact, at some of the group anniversaries, if they would be selling what we know is like 50-50s, some people would say, no, we're not going to do that. And then some people would say, what's the big deal? It's, you know, it's going to go back in the pot for rent or whatever. But I don't remember anything other than, you know, maybe at a group anniversary selling raffles. That was about it that I can recall.
Okay. Today, AA is well known and supported by police officers, judges, and corrections officials. What kind of relationship did AA in your area have with local authorities, and how has that changed?
Well, I mean, I would say, too, that the clergy really gave us a boost, too. You know, there was an old group in Brooklyn that was founded by one of the undertakers, Duffy, and that became like, well, is it a religious thing? What's, you know, is it a court thing? And we'd get people that came in from court. So we had a reputation that I think was respected. I think I mentioned that before. So it's up to AA to keep that respect going, not the outside world. We have to let it begin with me. So behave yourself and you'll have a good reputation, something I know little about.
All right. Well, treatment facilities today frequently host AA and other 12-step meetings. Did treatment centers exist in your area when you sobered up?
There were some hospitals, I do remember, that had meetings, like Bellevue had a meeting. But as far as, I didn't come through treatment center, I didn't know much about them, but I do remember that one. And then Smithers also, you know, we would take meetings in there. So they worked together with AA, but they really weren't affiliated with AA. So I saw that from day one, only because I didn't come out of a treatment center. So maybe I was more aware that AA had its own, we're standing on our own, and we're not affiliated with anybody.
Okay, today radio and television public service announcements for AA as well as internet websites are becoming commonplace. When you first got sober, how did AAs interact with the media?
I was able to, there's a radio station called Stepping Out, and couple of friends of mine, they asked us to come on and interview us, you know, but they were very aware of the traditions. And I was shocked because even Telecare out in Long Island here would invite members of AA and were very, very aware of not full names or showing the face and whatever. So I think, and then the PSAs, the public service announcements, most of them were done, you know, by the General Service Office. So I think they'd have to, you know, I think they have to take certain time for maybe AA or some other community service. So, you know, if they were forced to do it, I guess they did.
During the early years of your recovery, How did the community receive Alcoholics Anonymous?
Well, again, my experience in early sobriety in Brooklyn, I think AA had a good reputation, and they would encourage, and I think that's changed over the past 30 some odd years that I've seen, and I think that's on us. I really do. I mean, if you know, I want to be as honest as I can. So I'm the one that sometimes people say, oh, here's the AA police, because I would say, listen, this is a church. Why do you have to curse? Why do you have to scream? Why do you have to flick your cigarette butts? And believe me, I'm no pillar of, you know. But I think it has to begin with us. So if we want a good reputation, you have to project that reputation.
And that concludes the unity portion of our interview. And now we will move on to the third legacy of service. How and why did you get into service work?
I think the first thing I remember about service was they allowed me to open the door, set up the coffee. In Brooklyn, you did everything. You set the chairs up, you did. And I thought, that's a big responsibility. So I took it very seriously at that point. And I do remember I would set up the coffee, and I think, maybe I'll put it down at this end of the table. And my sponsor would say, no, it goes on this end. So you have to have a thick skin. And I started to develop that thick skin because I just thought, I'll just do what I want. And service is not about that. You do it with a servant's heart, but you can't just do whatever the heck you want. So it gives you some kind of thick skin, and I think it helps you get out of your comfort zone.
Okay, what do you remember of early conferences, assemblies, and conventions?
Well, I do remember we had, in 1987, my friend Althea and I were able to put together what was Brooklyn's Share a Day. And I thought, this is the greatest thing ever. So that was like, I was only maybe 4 years sober, and I was involved in something like that. Then later on, I mean, the most vivid thing in my mind is really the first international I went to in 85. It was AA's 50th birthday in Montreal, and Teddy said, we're going to go to Montreal to AA's 50th birthday. Lois Wilson was still alive. She was up on the stage, accepted a big book. Wooden Duffy. I mean, these are historical figures. And I'm saying, I mean, it didn't impress me then. And I remember one of the speakers saying, and you will become of maximum service. I didn't know that was out of the big book, but it resonated with me. And that was like something amazing to me, that all these alcoholics could get together and enjoy themselves without drinking. It was impressive.
Can you recall having any involvement in the opening of an intergroup or central office?
I do. Brooklyn had a very, I would say, weak intergroup. I don't know why, but there was only one guy that would run it. It was on King's Highway. But they had a very strong general service structure. So that I do remember. Then when I moved out here, in the early 90s, Queens Intergroup was just getting their start. They were on Metropolitan Avenue, and I remember going with some of the people from Nassau Intergroup, and they were getting a foothold in Queens there. That was exciting. And Intergroup is, you know, they do the up-close and personal work, so it's important. And I do remember also in Brooklyn, they weren't sending money to Brooklyn Intergroup. They were sending it to New York. And I said, well, why are you doing that when we have a local intergroup? So, I mean, even then I started to see that AA is local, even though it's global. The alcoholic's going to come right up to your doorway. So you better be prepared.
Okay, what was your first impression of AA's trusted servants, GSO staff, delegates? Describe any of your first encounters.
Yeah, I mean, I got involved in service with one of, I thought was one of the greatest guys I knew. His name was Bob. He said, Marie, you could be the DCM for this district. And I started to become involved that way. Then we would go up to the General Service Office occasionally on a Friday to their international meeting at 11 o'clock. That was so exciting to see where people would come from halfway around the world. And I felt kind of not jaded, but really like, I said, wow, this is like the epicenter of AA, which it is. We would go up there on a Friday, and it was just to see it, you know, at that level. It was very exciting, and I don't think I've lost that excitement over the years. I mean, I've known all the delegates in the Area 49. I know a couple of the trustees, but you know what? They put their pants on or their skirt on the same way I do.
All right. Can you describe some of your committee activities over your years of service?
Yeah, I love committee work because it really, again, will toughen up your skin. And I just see it in the works, you know, how to get something together and who's going to be involved. And it exhibits people's gifts. If you can take secretary's notes, I have one friend, I always go to her, I say, can you do this? And I always go to a treasurer that I know that can count the money because I can't do that. My husband used to, I joke with my husband, how could I be overdrawn? I have checks left. And I really would mean it because, but I'm a good steward of AA's money. So I would get the best bean counter and say, okay, I'll do this job if I can get my treasurer. So that was important to me. And committee work is just about committee. It's, you know, it's a group effort. So I love committee work. I've PI, you know, whatever, getting, I was chair of one of the last New York State conventions, the 40th. And for, I hope I didn't collapse it, but they stopped it. And that was great, the four areas in New York State. You would think a big state like New York could continue a state convention, but no. So, but committee work will show you really what you're made of.
Have you ever been involved with a General Service Conference or developed any advisory actions?
The only involvement I've had, I've been on, and I think you have too, Jimmy, the Hospitality Committee, helping take people, spouses of the delegates and trustees around New York, which is my home. And at some of the internationals, my friend Dennis, who he's gone to the big meeting, and he worked as... we have scholarships, so he would check out people who said, I don't have any money, and he'd say, let me see. And so I worked with him a little on that, and that was in Atlanta. Just things like that just show you how big AA really is, but yet you come back to your home group, and I'm grateful for that.
Okay, when it comes to service work that you've done, do you have any regrets or any mistakes you believe you made or any plans that failed that you wish had been successful?
Everything that I've done in service, I've done for me to stay sober. And let me tell you something, don't look for the recognition because it doesn't come. But I don't have any regrets. A couple of times they asked me to stand for certain things. I said, I not now, maybe down the road or something, but no. And like I say, your home group is the most important commitment you'll have. So I don't ever want it. Like I said, I've had two home groups. They're both solid groups. So I don't want to be the one to upset that apple cart.
Okay. Do you recall any special occasions during your time of AA service?
Special occasions. Well, you and I always would go to Liz's anniversary at Jones Beach, and people who don't know Liz, we just, We didn't lose her because we know exactly where she is, but she went on to that big meeting, and that was always exciting. Some of the anniversaries that my sponsored Teddy, I would go all the time and people would turn out. It was amazing. But things really on a local level too, like that. My home group's anniversary, we just made 60 before the pandemic hit. So that was exciting. People know it because it's the Halloween festivity, my favorite holiday of, you know. So those things are very important, and I would not ever want to miss any of those opportunities. Yeah.
How has AA changed, if it has, since you first found it?
I mean, it's the 21st century, and I remember reading in the step book that Bill looked to this in the new millennium. So I think that they had an indication that things might be a little different, but AA is spiritual throughout. That's it. If you don't believe it's spiritual, I don't know if you believe the ocean is wet because it's spiritual. So I don't see that changing. COVID just hit. We didn't know how we were going to deal with that. We got on a virtual platform and everybody was in a Hollywood square. And I, for one, said, I'm not doing that. And then I said, you better do it. And we set up a home group on that. And we have to change with the times, but I don't think we're going to change so much that I wouldn't recognize it after 40 years. I pray anyway. So,
do you see any particular changes in the fellowship and its service processes since your start in service?
I do see that people are not so anxious to do service. I don't know what that's about. As I say, in Brooklyn, we would, when the commitments would come up at the end of the month or 3 months or whatever the time frame was, we would fight. I'm doing the coffee. No, I'm doing the coffee. No, I mean, today it's a little different. Although I got to give him props in my home group, Johnny. Now that we're meeting and we don't have the opportunity to make coffee, he'll bring a half pot of coffee from his house, put it in a shopping cart, bring it down, and plug it in, and people will be able to have coffee. And I say to myself, I don't know that I do that, but some people still have that servant's heart, and he's one of them. Yourself too, Jimmy. I know that you do a lot of work. So I don't know if it's... Maybe they're not sponsored in a way that I sponsor. I say, listen, if you want to help, just pick something. And you don't have to be perfect. I mean, listen, again, it's a thick skin. If you're going to sit up in front of the room, that's okay. But I respect more the guys who swing the mop, who clean up. And that to me, like my friend Helen, who I mentioned early on, go and clean up all the coffee cups.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Marie.
Thank you.
And that concludes our interview, which has lasted approximately 47 minutes. I am grateful for the opportunity to record your history and make it a permanent record. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jimmy.